Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am Pat Schlarbaum, and today we will be discussing peregrine falcon nesting in Iowa that has increased from 16 to 21 nesting pairs this year. We will hear from the key people that made this happen. Cole Washburn, as chairman of the Iowa Falcon Recovery Team, will describe efforts to return falcons to Iowa. Dave Kester, a member of Bob Anderson's Raptor Resource Project, will talk about getting started in falconry and his experiences working with Bob. And Dr. Pat Reddick, co-chairman with Dr. Bud Tordoff of the Midwest Peregrine Falcon Recovery Committee. Peregrines were wiped out in Iowa from the Missouri River to the East Coast by 1965. The bird became a standard bearer for the Endangered Species Act in 1973. In 1977, a falcon breeding facility was created in Cornell University in upstate New York to raise young falcons to return to their native cliff sites. Along the Mississippi and Iowa, as many as five nesting pairs existed historically. Peregrines are a type of bird of prey like hawks or owls called raptors. They have keen eyesight, many times better than ours, toe-like talons for grasping prey, and beaks for ripping or tearing meat. So that's what makes a raptor, keen eyesight, talons for grasping their prey, and a sharp beak. Peregrines are also called duck hawks or pigeon hawks that eat other birds. They are the fastest bird on the planet that can drop from the sky with speeds approaching 260 miles per hour. Peregrine falcons historically nested along the cliffs of the Mississippi River in far northeastern Iowa. During the Second World War, an insidious insecticide was developed to kill mosquitoes, DDT. It could also kill songbirds immediately, but it was in the long term that the insidious nature of the poison, which accumulated in the biology of birds of prey, that became so perilous. In rather short order of two decades, it destroyed the peregrine falcons in Iowa and most of the birds that came in contact with it, either directly or indirectly. Let me introduce Lowell Washburn from Clear Lake, Iowa. Lowell is retired from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and is a falconer, one of those folks who accompany a peregrine falcon on hunting forays. Lowell has done more for falcons and their return than anyone in Iowa. His outreach continues as a strong voice for the environment with his writing and stunning photography. Lowell is the best spokesperson for wildlife that I have the privilege of knowing. Welcome to Local Talk. Yep. We have a wonderful development of peregrine falcons on the river. This year, I guess you're aware that we've grown to 21 nesting pairs. Tell us a little about your work at the Dubuque Limestone Quarry, please.
A lifelong dream was to have free-flying populations of peregrine falcons back in Iowa, and we did have the beginnings of a population in the urban areas in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids, and a growing population in some other Midwestern cities and St. Paul and so on. But the birds had failed to come back to their historic nesting range on the upper Mississippi River. And as the years ticked away, that natural crossover that we'd all hoped for from the skyscrapers to the cliff just didn't occur. And so we put together what we call the Iowa Peregrine Falcon Recovery Team, which was a group of natural resource professionals and a wider cadre of private sector volunteers that all united in a common cause. And we said, if at all humanly possible, we're going to get this thing done. And so we started fundraising. That was the first thing we had to do. And pretty soon, we got some trust funds behind us. We got some energy companies and things like that. The DNR kicked in some money, and pretty soon we had enough to actually do a viable release. So for 2 years, we released the largest number of falcons that had ever been released on the river or attempted. And at the same time, there was another release going on north at Marquette at Hanging Rock at Effigy Mounds National Monument, and then down at the Loaiza Power Plant farther south down the river. And so we had three different points that we were injecting, if you will, peregrines into the Mississippi River. And wonder of wonders, it worked. Originally, the goal was to someday, and nobody even thought this was possible, but they set the goal high to have five nesting pairs of peregrine falcons, and these would be urban birds, in Iowa. And to think that this year we picked up more than what the original goal was, just in extra nesting pairs, just an incredible story.
Yes, it is, absolutely. And I might mention that those three release sites in 1999 and 2000 was after the federal government had deemed them no longer endangered, but they were not on the cliffs, by understanding your remarks.
Yeah, and we had a summit meeting of sorts up at the University of Minnesota, which had coordinated the Mid-Continent recovery work, and there was, it wasn't smooth sailing. There was some pretty heated debate over whether this river work should be attempted or not, and the main concern was that horned owls would predate these unprotected young birds that we were releasing, and it would just be a black eye for everybody involved. Plus, nobody felt that we had the peregrine falcons to spare in such a reckless manner to risk them on the cliff. Here again, wonder of wonders, we didn't realize it until, because they were so secretive, until the releases actually started at Dubuque, that there was actually a pair of great horned owls nesting on the same 200-foot cliff that we were releasing birds from. And it was a real tense, but we thought, wow, should we go ahead with this, not go ahead with it? We had the birds are ready to go into the hack boxes. We said, listen, if we don't do it, we're not going to find out. We went ahead and did it there. Not only did the horned owls not take any of the young peregrines, as everyone had feared they would, but by the time the peregrines had fledged and been on the wing for a couple weeks, they were literally driving the horned owls off the site, or at least back into the woodwork.
So the listeners understand, you are a falconer. You had some cohorts, Tom Deckert and Rob Kirkman, come to mind. So it was three falconers that had a vision and essentially followed through on that. Why did that mean so much to you at that time?
We just knew that the birds were available and that the time was right. And it was something that Tom Deckert and Rob Kirkman and I had talked about for a long time, and we'd all had a lifelong passion for falcons, peregrine falcons in particular. So it was just kind of a hand-in-glove deal. We were all in the right place at the right time, and by the grace of God, it all worked. It was just an incredible project. And go to the river today and to see and hear and just watch those birds perform their, from their courtship to when the young fledge, and they're doing all these mock combat battles in the skies over their territory. I mean, I can't begin to tell you what a feeling it gives me to see the sun come up over the Mississippi River on the Wisconsin side, and there you have that early morning light just tinging the colors of those birds as they fly and chase prey items over the river and bring food back to their young, and then watch the young leave the nest. It just gives me goosebumps. I have some Lakota friends out in the Black Hills, and when they're really happy about something, they use the term that it makes their heart soar. It means they're really gratified. They're really happy, and that's what it does for me. When I see those families of peregrines over their historic cliff sites again after it was predicted that they would be extinct, and I lamented the fact that never in my lifetime would I see a wild peregrine. When I was in high school, they predicted they were gone. They'd never be back. And now to see them, it truly does make my heart soar, too. It's just an indescribable feeling.
And can the listeners go to Eagle Point Park and see falcons?
There's several places on the river, actually, that offer extremely easy viewing. Yeah. One is Eagle Point Park, not just the park itself, but that, there's a street that runs between the cliff at the park and the river called Romberg Avenue. And you can park literally right on Romberg Avenue and look up into those eyries and watch the peregrines along with vultures that nest in those cliffs and all the other Mississippi River bird life right literally from your car window.
That's in Dubuque.
Just north of Paint Rock at Waukon Junction on a stretch called Leo's Bluff. There's peregrine activity there. Again, there's a turnoff. You can just watch it from literally, again, from your car window. And then farther north at Lansing at Aggie's Bluff, there's another kind of a horseshoe parking area that comes right off the road that parallels the highway that parallels the river. And again, you can look right up into those cliffs and see those birds. So there's at least three places on the upper Mississippi River where you can watch peregrine falcons that aren't on a skyscraper. They're not on a smokestack. They're not in a nest box. They're just coming and going out of natural crevices in the cliff like they have for thousands of years.
Thank you, Lowell Washburn. From the heart, you make our heart soar with the falcons.
Good to talk to you.
Please plan to return. This is a story with wings, and there'll be other stories, I'm sure, but particularly there in Dubuque, Eagle Point Park, the rock quarry facing the river, and also there's a nesting pair in the courthouse in Dubuque. So you've got the best of the urban and the best of the wilds. What a story. 21 nesting pairs. Thank you, Lowell Washburn.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio at 89.1 FM. Today we're talking about peregrine falcons, a previously endangered bird of prey that hunts other birds. We've been listening to Lowell Washburn, the head of the Iowa Peregrine Falcon Recovery Team. Dave Kester will share his thoughts and work with Decorah Eagle man Bob Anderson. Unfortunately, Bob passed away suddenly July 27th, so we wanted to share the continuing efforts of Bob's Raptor Resource Project work.
Dave Kester, welcome to Local Talk. Dave, you live in Northeast Iowa?
Yeah, I'm a Decorah native. I grew up in Decorah, raising my kids there, yep.
Yeah, and you're one of the key people with the Raptor Resource Project. Do you recall when you first met Bob Anderson?
It was in 97, and I had just moved back to Decorah, and some buddies helped move me back. And the night they did that, after we got down, of course, I took them down to one of the places in town to give them supper, and Bob was in there. And I had read about him in the paper, and I was like, wow, you're Bob Anderson, you're that guy? And I was in his ear all night long, so that was the first time I met him.
And you're a falconer. Is that when you kind of got started with falconry?
I hardly know anything about it at that point. In fact, I knew very little about hawks even at that point. With Bob, I was so excited about his peregrine work. It just, what it was just sounded cool.
Okay.
And I told him, I was like, boy, I'd sure like to help. And with Bob, he didn't call you when he needed help. You called him when you were available.
Yeah.
So I had to start calling him, and basically every day and check in. And he said, what's going on? And he would say, this, and I would go help. But through Bob then, he was also a falconer, a long time, lifelong falconer. And I saw him fly his bird and then other friends of his and really got fired up about it through Bob. And then not only did he teach me about work with him in the peregrine reintroduction on the cliff sites, but he also became my sponsor for falconry. So I was lucky enough to be trained in falconry by one of the best.
By one of the masters. And maybe for the listeners, can you give us, you start off as an apprenticeship?
Right. There's three levels, apprentice, and then general, and then master. The apprentice is a two-year. You need to find either a general class or master class falconer who will take you and train you. And after 2 years as an apprentice, if they sign off on you, then you can get your generals. But they take you, and you can have a bird at apprenticeship. You start then, but you do it under the guidance of an experienced falconer.
Okay.
That way you are learning how to do the techniques and, do right by the bird.
Sure, you kind of become one with your birds.
Well, there's without a doubt a bond.
Okay.
I think that's one of the things that attracts me. I learned as much with what I know in regards to raptors through the interaction of hunting and flying. I've always had red tails. Learning the behavior, I learned untold amount of behavior in that close interaction with the hawk.
That's pretty exciting. You're very unique individuals that take this on. What was your motivation, or did you just kind of grow into this?
Well, that's kind of, Pat, that's a good way to put it, because it was kind of a natural evolution. Like I said before, when I met Bob, and that's when he had moved from Minnesota to Decorah to start working with the Iowa DNR and Iowa Recovery Team to try to establish cliff nesting peregrines along up the Mississippi River. I threw myself into that. I became heavily involved, being available to Bob, and of course learning through him. And then I grew into, and like I said, he was also a falconer, which is, I'm sure, where the passion for saving the peregrine comes from. I didn't even know this world existed, and I was I was hooked from day one. And but you know, it's a huge responsibility. I didn't start, I think, until 2002. You know, and the first time I saw Bob Flyer Bird was in 97. You got to have you got to have your situation right. You know, in order to husbandry an animal like that
and your priorities. So
the priorities. Exactly.
Is it fair to say that Bob took you under his wing, so to speak?
Oh, without a doubt.
Okay.
And I'm grateful.
Carry that gratitude well, Dave Kester. We'll leap into, there's a famous image I've seen with you and Bob and John Dingley at Hanging Rock, placing falcons in a release structure in 1998. Do you remember that, those moments when it was time to place these birds, knowing that their next level of development would be free flying over the rivers?
Yeah, I sure do. I have a much greater appreciation for what exactly was done there and what happened than I did at the time. I keep falling back phrase. I was very like, wow, this is really cool. This is really neat. I was just happy to be there. But, and like I said, when I first met Bob, I was pretty unknowledgeable. But over time, gaining the comprehension that I have and looking back on what was done there and the success story that's growing out of there, I have a much greater appreciation for it. But yeah, I remember those days fondly, and I can still see the images vividly.
Well, there were, I believe there were 9 birds that first year.
Right.
You guys had your hands full, as I recall. There was some visitation where we could watch from afar. We were like a quarter mile away.
That was that third scenic view along the walking trail out to Hanging Rock. Scopes, it was pristine view.
So they were young birds, maybe 35, 36 days of age. And they still had some down, as I recall, and they went into this structure, and you guys kept showing up and trying to feed them in such a way they wouldn't imprint on humans. And I guess at 42 days of age or so, they were ready to fly. What did that seem like?
Yeah, that was incredible. There was, you know, I think it was 4 or 5, a mixture of tiercels and falcons, and the tiercels, males being smaller, they have a tendency to fly first. It's a fine line between when you open up the box. You don't want them over age where you open up the box and they blow out.
Yeah.
You want them at that age where you open it up, and you also want them, you want to have fed them, so they kind of just maybe slowly creep out and come out on the perches and look around their world and be in no hurry to go anywhere. That's best case scenario.
Right. You're not tossing them in the air for the benefit of the cameras. It's all done passively.
That whole thing, it's called a hack release, which is tried and true historic falconry technique for training young raptors. And so, you know, once again, we're using the falconer's expertise in order to accomplish this biological effort.
There's a window in time that, and that's a real good point. I mean, this is, the art of falconry goes back thousands of years, I think 4,000 years as many.
Right.
So this is not a new area, but it was new to that situation on the river. I think the listeners can appreciate the dedication and the commitment that the Raptor Resource Project were able to create these little falcons, I mean, you know, through artificial insemination and having the adults raise them. And then they were on the north side of his house there in the mews for a time. And then...
Right, we built that false eyrie on the back side of his house so we could access it through a back porch so we could observe and feed them without them, you know, seeing us. And all they knew was... Well, at that time, it was vast acres of CRP in the rock hole they were living in.
Yeah, nothing man-made.
Right.
So then they were transported over to the river.
We took them there. You know, in Effigy Mounds, their staff was great, you know, because we had to get these boxes were big and they were heavy.
Yeah.
And we had to get them up that single-track trail all the way out to Hanging Rock and then get them secured on top of the bluff. And then, you know, once the birds went in, they were there a week, you know, so they, you know, without the doors being open, so they could just see their new environment and get used to the lay of the land, so to speak. Yeah. And we would have to hike out every day to feed them and run the mosquito gauntlet. I swear to God, I saw Bob Anderson just go stark raving mad trying to outrun the mosquitoes. But, yeah, so we had to do that every day until the day of release when we opened the door.
So there was a moment there where you were less drama is what you're hoping for. And so did any fly on cue?
They just really just crept out. They didn't even come out right away. If memory serves, Bob went over to Third Scenic. So he was on the scope so he could observe.
Oh, sure.
And then I opened up the boxes and I had very specific information and instructions about how to do this. But get those doors open and then get out of there, you know, as quietly as possible. And they just, you know, they didn't even come out right away. It took a while. And then they would kind of, you know, one brave soul kind of stood on the, you know, the lip of the box and looked around. And then, you know, we had these latticework of perches for them to kind of come out and just play on.
Yeah.
And they eventually just did that. But so, by the afternoon, you know, in that first night, I remember this vividly, Pat. They came out onto the rock. You know, these boxes were on top of the cliff, but there was this rock that they could get on the lip of, and it was a sheer face, a limestone cliff. And they would just hop around down onto these little, you know, six-inch ledges, you know, down a few feet and go around, you know. And I remember to this day Bob going, like, look at that. I mean, they weren't raised by parents. There hasn't been peregrines on rocks in 40 years. And they come out there and just start walking around. They were just hardwired was the word he used. You know, they're hardwired to be on those rocks like that. And they just went about their business like they've always been there.
Oh, sure. And that was like a sheer cliff face, 300 feet to the water.
Straight down.
When one finally did go on wing, was there a lot of flapping or was it more soaring?
It's more of a glide.
Glide, okay.
They take the leap and they set their wings. There's some flapping, you know, but it's clumsy, inefficient, and then they kind of set their wings, and then they just go, kind of just follow the contours of the bluff and would plow into the canopy and find a place to perch, you know, and then you go like, holy cow, what was that all about?
Yeah.
But, you know, and eventually would work their way back to the box, but they would be gone for hours a lot of the times. I don't recall one going off on a glide or a flight and just immediately circling back and coming back to the box. They take that leap and they set their wings, and some are better at it than others.
Yeah, and Bob had probably witnessed this at other release sites hundreds of times.
Right.
But I can only imagine that sheer joy, relief. I imagine he ran the gamut of emotions and nervous
energy.
It was
a long road to get to that point.
You got
to watch
brown
peregrines set their wings and take off and fly free over the Mississippi River from a cliffside.
That was
his dream.
Yeah, and you were there. Okay, now we've got these birds on wing. And then it's probably time to have at least a discussion about, are there any great horned owls that are going to upset this this joyful activity? Did you ever witness any anything that kind of made you concerned about the welfare of these young falcons?
Not from great horned owls. There was no issue there at all. And like I said, I was a neophyte to that. Bob had told me about the concern with great horned owls and falcon releases, and I think there'd been releases before where it was not an optimal situation for releasing peregrines, and it was kind of in horned owl habitat.
Yeah,
but I don't think we ever saw a horned owl at these effigy mound releases. You know, the barred owls were there, but they, you know, I was more their type of habitat, and they didn't pay the falcons any mind at all. The one thing that we did experience actually was there were some turkey vultures and a red-tailed hawk riding a thermal in front of the cliff, and the babies were the ISs were out on perches mid-morning, late morning, and the red tail peeled off and just, you know, he'd been there for a while and riding the thermal, and he peeled off and came down, and then he knocked one of the tiercels off perch, and that bird went down, and we thought, well, just lost one. But he eventually worked his way back up. I think it took him a couple of days.
Oh, my goodness. Uh-huh.
So, But he eventually worked his way back to the site, and so we had, you know, we still were able, all nine, successfully fledged and dispersed from those, from that site. But I can still, I just, yeah, so that was that red tail. But, you know, and that kind of brings up, now that we have cliff birds, it's an awful lot of fun to, or at least exciting, to watch, and you've seen this, the pair reestablish its territory on a cliff and educate and re-educate certain birds who are kind of used to flying in front of a, you know, that visible window in front of a cliff face, and the peregrines reestablish their ownership there, that red tails and owls or vultures or eagles, crows, nobody flies in front of that rock anymore.
Yeah, the blue beanie has returned, and that's just a clever name that that Bob had read, and the blue meanie.
Right.
With their territorial nature, they were back on the rocks, and that, so it was a, you know, like a new sheriff in town, I guess, and for lack of a better
metaphor. Right. So it's been a long time since they had to negotiate, you know, the peregrine corridor up the Mississippi, you know,
right,
from cliff to cliff.
It is nice to point out that there are other raptors on the river,
right,
that are utilizing those same thermals that the falcons are utilizing, and you're going to have interaction, is it, I guess,
yeah,
the best word for it.
Most certainly, that's nature.
Yeah.
With that brand new population, we want to monitor that population. We were putting bands on all the young that we could get to, and that meant going over the cliffs on ropes to access the eyries. And yeah, I didn't have a lot of experience before I went over my first cliff, and that's a feeling I'll never forget.
Okay. Oh, well, what did it feel like?
Well, I see if I can describe it. What happened is that we had equipment at Bob's farm, got on the harness, and you know, the gree-gree and the crawl, some of the pieces of equipment and the ascender, and he would have us practice kind of going up and down. We threw a rope over a low branch on his bur oak tree and had to go up and down that, you know. Then I went up to Rochester, Minnesota to have a lesson to get a little more familiar with the equipment. And I think I was there for 45 minutes. Some young guy showed me how to operate the stuff and then set me on my merry little way. And the very next day, I'm putting the equipment on, and I'm going backwards off Maiden Rock with Bob to go down to that nest. And, it's pretty indescribable. It took a lot of mind over matter.
And a lot of faith.
It was thrilling. Yeah. It was frightening. It was exhilarating. But I've since learned that, when you become familiar and comfortable with the equipment, when you have faith in the equipment, you know, as long as you are paying attention and you're safe, you can do most anything on there. If something happens and you lose faith in your equipment, you can't get off a rope fast enough.
Oh, sure. So now, what is it that means the most to you when you see falcons there at Leo's Bluff? Why don't you tell us how Leo's Bluff got its name?
That was my friend Bob Anderson being caught in the act of being Bob, in that Leo's Bluff is up there near Waukon Junction, Nobles Island, Paint Rocks, you know, Harper's Ferry, that stretch of cliff face that runs right along the road, right over the Mississippi by Harper's Ferry. I think it was the first year that we had peregrine on that particular cliff that was just upstream from Paint Rock. And as far as he could tell, it was an unnamed cliff. So he didn't have a reference for it. Now, at the time, I think my son was one.
Yeah, that's about right.
You know, I think he was a baby. He was pretty new to the world. And Bob, you know, in his graciousness, decided to name that bluff Leo's Bluff. So he named it after my son. It looked like it's sticking.
Yeah, it works for me. So you get to stand at Aggie's Bluff and see birds that you can't access.
We can't get to.
but they put on
That's a tough one. That's on a chimney. That is just, yeah. You know, when we go into these sites, we want to do it as safely as possible, but we want to do it as quickly as possible. We don't want to stress out the parents too much. We want to get to the site. We want to get the bands on the babies, and we want to get the heck out of there.
Right.
And this site is just, you know, it's a chimney, and I could not find a safe way to get from the cliff to the top of that other chimney to rope down on that. Once you're there, it's a straight shot down, it'd be no problem. So I think we're looking this fall to go there, with, you know, spend a day there and just really investigate that and find a way to safely navigate that rock system. And get it's hard to watch those babies, you know, because there's such a great viewing platform there that you can see them out on the ledge, but, you know, not be able to get to them and
carry on your research efforts. But we're talking about a site that's about 2 miles north of Lansing. There is a nice pull-off between the river and the cliff, and a nice little amphitheater. And what a spot.
It's a good viewing spot. And they pull off, and the birds are visible there.
Yeah. Well, Dave, is there anything else you'd like to...
You asked about a good story, and then you brought up John Strawbers, and that does bring to mind one, if you'll tolerate me.
Anything that has to do with Hawk.
Well, this is when Leo was probably about a year old, with the springtime, and Hawker had Pam and Leo and I out in his boat, and we were out for a little boat ride, and of course we went up, you know, in front of Leo's bluff, and we were watching the peregrines that were raising a family there. And we were out on the water, and we were out back away from the Iowa shore quite a ways. We were closer to, you know, kind of the island, you know, of the backwaters. And Pam and Leo were on the bow of the boat, and I was in the middle, and John was at the back. And so I was facing John, and we were talking. And we both look at the cliff, and we see at the same time, we see the male falcon leap off his cedar snag perch and comes on a stoop, and he's coming right at us. He's dropping down, he's coming right at us, he's gaining speed, and then we see this tree swallow that is flying right at us. And the tiercel is in hot pursuit of the swallow. Now, the swallow's out over water. He is toast. He's got nowhere to go. So he goes to the only thing that he can find to save himself, and that's us.
Or your boat.
So he comes right at us, and he flies right between John and I. Zip. He rides right between us. And then the tiercel is so intent on him, he doesn't see us until he gets within 15 yards at the most. He's that close. When he finally realizes that we're there, and he does this, he cuts off, and he banks up, and then goes up into this big soar, you know, and pulls out. And John and I, we're looking at him. Our mouths are agape. Our eyes are bug-eyed. We look at him. We look at each other. We look at the tiercel again. We look at each other again. It's like, did you see that? And we're freaking out. And Pam and Leo saw nothing.
But they get the story for the rest of their life.
They missed the whole thing. And John and I are just over the moon. There's just no way you can describe what a thrill that was, you know. And, I mean, that swallow, I mean, John and I are 3 feet apart, and that swallow goes 4 feet, maybe. And he goes right between us. He went for the only thing, and he poured in a storm, they say.
Oh, yeah.
And we saved it. We saved his butt that day.
Yeah, inadvertently, but your heart was in a good place, you know. So you've done the climbing. You've done everything. Are you considered a general falconer then? Or a master?
I'm a master class.
You're a master class. How many years dedication was that?
I believe it takes 7 to get to that.
7 years.
That level.
Mm-hmm. And congratulations on that, Dave Kester.
Well, thank you.
You're one of the few and the proud. But you guys have really stepped up, comes to not only peregrines, but for all raptors, and you're a voice that this community can certainly appreciate for many years to come.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, because I know there's some people who don't understand falconry and don't care for it, but I defy you to find a more passionate community about the conservation required to protect raptors and hence other species than the falconry community.
You have led the way, and we're indebted to your service to the birds, and express our sincere appreciation for peregrine falcons back on the cliffs. Thank you, Dave Kester.
You bet, Pat. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio at 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. And today we're talking about peregrine falcons. We've been listening to Dave Kester, a very key environmentalist, tell us about his contributions to returning peregrine falcons to the cliffs of the Mississippi River in far northeast Iowa. Dr. Pat Reddick, retired director of the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota, wants to share his overview of the historic work that returned a previously endangered species before going extinct. Like the mythological phoenix that arose from the ashes, peregrine falcons have returned. And you are the Midwest coordinator for the peregrine falcon recovery?
Yes.
When did you start that role?
About 1982.
And there were some historic releases of peregrine falcons at that time?
Well, yes. You know, the history goes back to the 70s, the Peregrine Fund and their work on the East Coast and breeding falcons and establishing the means for releasing them out there.
So this has been a big part of your career?
My career really started as a professor here at the university in 1980 and shortly thereafter. I was involved in the 78 and 79 release as a graduate student at the time.
And, oh, sure.
So, from 1982 forward to, really to the present. It's been some 30 years, and very much a feature of my professional and personal excursions, activities.
Well, I understand you're a veterinarian.
That's correct.
A falconer also?
Well, that was where my beginnings with raptors started. It was way back when, as a teenager, with a real keen interest in falcons and falconry, and had a lot of experience with them before I even got to this point.
Well, what were the initial goals of the peregrine falcon recovery?
Well, very modest by comparison with what we ended up with, let's put it that way.
Okay.
Under the Endangered Species Act, recovery plans were developed for the peregrine in various locations across the country. And in establishing our goals here for the Midwest, we followed their general template, which said we would like to reestablish one half of what the estimated original historical population was as a self-sustaining population. We had about 50 active sites in the Midwest, including those on the north shore of Lake Superior, in the Mississippi River at any one time. So we met our goals when we had 25 to 30 pair of falcons established nesting in the Midwest. Of course, now, as you well know, we're well over 200.
And that was early in the 1990s when the 25 threshold was achieved?
Yeah. We started releasing in 82 some sites down, again, along the Mississippi River. And after several years of modest success, but no real sustained nesting activity there, we retreated, if you will, or changed strategies,
mm-hmm,
and
sure,
went to releasing them in various cities in the Midwest, beginning in Minneapolis and going to Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I kind of lose track of the order of things at that point, but as you well know, we ended up also down in Cedar Rapids, Iowa at one point, too.
Sure.
And then the Quad Cities area.
Sure.
But anyway, those city releases turned out to be the key to success. Almost immediately, the birds came back and started nesting in cities, and I think within a few years, probably I would say 3 or 4 years, we'd gotten to that 25 nesting pair real.
And the cities, what, assimilated the cliffs? And could you discuss?
Well, they replaced or served as a suitable nesting site for the falcons. In the 20 years that the falcons were gone, we had this proliferation of very tall buildings. The city center building in Minneapolis that we used as our original release site is like an 800-foot tall building. Up there, the birds were just high, which they like to be, and they were free from predation, and also just had an abundant supply of pigeons and other birds that they could utilize as a food source. So all the necessary ingredients were right there. Plus, they had an adoring public that watched every move that they made.
Great connection to our constituents. You mentioned the predators. What would be considered a predator of that?
On the cliffs where we initially established the falcons with releases there, Weaver Dunes, raccoons and great horned owls were really our chief concerns.
Oh, I see.
And caused the predation that prevented us from actually establishing nest sites there. And you have to remember that, the birds used to nest there successfully for probably thousands of years in cohabitation with these predators, but they had very savvy adults that had grown up with those predation forces and knew how to select nest sites and how to defend their nest sites. We were putting young, unskilled, uneducated birds, if you will, out mm-hmm. there, and they had to learn the hard way.
Yeah, and essentially unprotected without the parental
yeah.
rings that those parents would provide. Well, that's fascinating, to say the least, that the urban setting really became the keystone.
I regarded them as our not only the keystone, but they, you know, I think became our nursery population because as the birds became established in the cities and were very, very successful at nesting and producing lots of offspring, these birds were flying up and down the Mississippi River and other places on their migrations, and they mm-hmm. still had their, you know, ancient inclinations to seek out cliffs and things like that. And after a period of time of surviving in the wild and the cities actually becoming too crowded, to, if you will, to accommodate any more peregrines, they really began exploring these cliff sites. And in the year 2000, so that would have been about 14 years after we started our first successful releases in the city.
Sure, and 14 years ago.
We had five pairs suddenly appeared on the Mississippi River, and they've been successful there and continue to expand and grow that population ever since.
Well, you mentioned so the early work in the cities, the urban areas. When was the first nesting pair established in the Twin Cities?
That goes right back to the beginning. We released the first birds in Minneapolis in 1986, and among that cohort of birds that was released there, there was one bird in particular named MF1, also dubbed Muffin, but she was produced by a breeder here in the Twin Cities area, also a falconer, Bob Anderson, who is still, as you well know, very much associated with peregrine work on the Mississippi.
Sure.
And then the Minnesota Falconers Association purchased that bird from him for release in Minneapolis.
Oh, hence the name or initials MF.
Yes, hence the initials MF.
Minnesota Falconers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then anyway, she fledged successfully. In the spring, she came back and she was at the multi-food site and she paired with an adult male that had been released on the river, actually, and had come into the city. And they took over that site. So we were no longer able to release birds from that site and they started nesting there and it became really a watershed at that point.
Sure. Well, you also mentioned the territoriality of these birds. What would be a distance of separation that you were striving for?
Well, yeah, there's no hard and fast rule on that.
Yeah.
And the cities and the configuration of the cities really changes the game in that respect. You know, mostly what they need to be is out of each other's sight. And we used to think in terms of a 1, 2, or 3 miles because we did, we had falcon attacks occurring over those kinds of distances when we attempted to release other falcons.
I see.
But now as we see how this nesting population has settled in, we have in Minneapolis, we have 3 falcon sites that are within 6 blocks of each other.
So as the birds establish or develop their own identities, then consequently the territoriality has been shrinking?
Well, let's just say it's changed.
Okay.
You know, a lot of it depends on the configuration of the buildings and a lot of it's the temperament of the adults. Some of them are just really aggressive and won't tolerate other birds, and others are more temperate. And this is shifting. It goes back and forth as you get different occupants of the sites, and some will come down with their elbows out and claim a lot more room than others, and it changes back and forth over time.
Well, what did it mean to you when that MF1, as you say, released that bird, and here it is defending its own young? What did that mean to you?
Well, I mean, we were just absolutely thrilled to death to see that happen. I mean, because it happened so fast. You know, we'd gone through years of releasing birds down on the Mississippi River and agonized over watching them come back and try to nest and then suffering predation from the various critters out there. And to all of a sudden have this pair come back in the city. And I have to be honest with you, when we first contemplated releasing birds in the cities, I was somewhat of a purist about this and felt, you know, no, falcons belong on the cliffs. We need to continue doing that, you know.
Oh, okay.
And so all of a sudden seeing them come back to the cities and seeing it work so elegantly well, it was just, a paradigm shift, quite frankly, and just absolutely delighted by it. And it was not, you know, that was the first one is always interesting and significant and exciting, to be sure. But, you know, anytime you can, I always feel like, you can get lucky and do anything once.
Okay.
Know?
Yeah.
But when it repeats the year following and the year after that and the year after that on an expanding scale, that's when it really settles in that this is working and it's really, really fantastic. You know, not only did we have that great success with MF1 there in Minneapolis, but some other birds from that same release year, that cohort, one of them flew down and set up housekeeping in Chicago.
Oh, on the Wacker.
On the Wacker.
Yeah.
And then, so not only did the birds do amazing things like that, we had another one that actually went up to the north shore of Lake Superior, blueberry, and started nesting up there. And then, beyond that, though, was just the response. Next thing I knew, we had a call from an agency person with the Michigan DNR, Bob Hess, who was excited about the prospects of doing this in Michigan. And then Wisconsin got involved, Iowa got involved, Indiana and Ohio. And so there was just this rapid expansion across all of the states in the Midwest.
It is a good thing. And, well, I recall a meeting in 1989 that the Peregrine Falcons were coming to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and the fun was about to begin. That's a quote from you. Well, they spun their magic, all the states of the Midwest, thanks to your leadership on that. What's the future hold for these indicator species like Peregrine Falcons?
One thing about the Peregrine, I think to put it in perspective, that we should keep in mind, you know, clearly it was extirpated entirely because of people, things that people did, primarily with pesticide application. And then also, of course, there was the sentiments, if you will, in the 30s and 40s and 50s towards raptors and a lot of other things, you know, with regard to indiscriminate shooting and persecution and then habitat destruction and so on and so forth. But with the peregrines, the pesticide was the biggest factor.
Oh, the DDT.
Yeah. And, you know, when we removed that from the environment and the environment cleaned up a lot faster, I think, than anybody ever thought it would. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that cleared the way for the peregrine to be restored with help from us. So what I'm saying is that, you know, we had a bird that fortunately had a lot of followers in the falconry community in particular, and they developed the means for captive propagation and things like that, and were able to produce the birds in sufficient numbers that we, and with sufficient genetic diversity, that we could reestablish, get them through the bottleneck and reestablish the population. But they really had one problem, and we eliminated that, and then with some help, we were able to get them on their way again. But, you know, as far as where we go from here, my big concern is, and this again is a relative thing, bear in mind that, you know, historically and going back into the early 1900s, there were some indications. Joe Hickey at Madison, Wisconsin, had done a survey in the 40s, which was well before the pesticide area, and determined that in the Midwest area here that we call our scope or area of influence, there were probably about 120 known falcon eyries, of which, as I mentioned earlier, about 50 or so were occupied in any one year, as far as we knew. Well, we're five times that now in terms of population. But 50% of that population is maintained on buildings and bridges. And all of those sites require active management. Falcons require a lot of upkeep for those sites. And so going forward, I think we'll see what happens. The nice thing about the falcon, as you mentioned before, is just the magic that they create. There's been this grassroots assemblage of people that have literally come out of the limestone.
A collective strength.
and really support the falcon. And really, I mean, the maintenance of the falcons on a lot of these building sites and things like that is because of the interest and enthusiasm for private groups of people that are looking after them. And as long as that continues and we get good cooperation from building owners, what's been most gratifying about the whole thing, and that's not just the Peregrine, but the whole environmental movement, if you will, since that got underway in the 70s, is just this big change in attitude that we've had in our people. And they really understand the necessity for stewardship and have a different relationship with wildlife. And I think that I don't see a reason why that won't continue. And as long as it does, I think the Peregrine is going to do well.
It's a brighter future with those people
that
are wanting to maintain what's been established. Do you have advice for those in our listening public about the falcons that you'd like to share with?
There's something that needs to be enjoyed in the wild. I know there's lots of good videos and things like that out there that you can see the amazing things that these birds do, but, you know, the best place to see and appreciate and understand what these guys are all about is really on the cliffs on the Mississippi River and the adjoining rivers. The birds in the city are wonderful to watch, and we certainly enjoy them. But, you know, when you get out there on the river and get in the midst of those towering limestone and dolomite cliffs, if you don't know it already, learn about it, or if you do know it, think about the long history of the area and the peoples that have been there and the falcons that were part of that habitat and that existence, those cultures for literally thousands of years. It allows you to become part of a long history and tradition of things that have gone on there, and just gain an appreciation for our place and our role in the environment as part of something that's much larger than ourselves. Nothing brings a cliff to life like having a pair of falcons soaring over it or defending their young, things like that, and feeding their young.
And hearing the calls.
And hearing the calls, yeah. They just echo through the rocks up there and just bring the place alive. Yeah. That's what you need to get out and experience.
Yeah, we feel that even Rachel Carson would want us, authored The Silent Spring, that she would want us to go out and hear these birds.
Oh, absolutely.
Silent no longer. I'm certainly honored and privileged that you'd take the time to join us here today.
it's my pleasure. I can't thank you enough. It's one of those things that I just wouldn't pass up the opportunity to do it. So it's fun to talk about.
Avoiding complacency. That's,
yep.
That's our goal currently here in Iowa, and this really helps.
You bet. Well, that's the key to all of this stuff, isn't it? The work is never completely done. There's always more people that need to be exposed to all of this and learn to enjoy it the way we have.
Yeah, we are becoming. And,
yeah,
and some things are brighter than the kinds that we grew up with initially.
They really are. And
Dr. Reddick, University of Minnesota, St. Paul, the Raptor Center, Director Emeritus, I can't thank you enough.
All right. Well, it was my pleasure, and thanks for the opportunity, Pat. Appreciate all the work that you guys are doing down there. It is just absolutely terrific.
Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. Bye now.
Bye for now. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today we have been discussing Iowa's peregrine falcons. We have been talking with Lowell Washburn, an engaging conservationist of real action with his extensive writing skills and stunning photography. Dave Kester, board member of the Raptor Resource Project and the best partner a falconry bird can have. And Dr. Pat Reddick, who co-chaired the Midwest Peregrine Falcon Restoration Committee and is the retired director of the Raptor Center. As a wildlife veterinarian, Dr. Reddick's motivation and knowledge about raptors is legendary around the world. Dr. Reddick, Dave Kester, and Lowell Washburn are each environmental treasures to the planet. Technical assistance has been provided by Rick Morrison. The music you heard was The Cloud Forest by the Barn Owl Band on Barn Owls Live. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can listen to this show and all our past shows online or at our website, khoyfm.org. And you will see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. You will also find lists of our guests and contact information to the organizations as we speak with and other resources mentioned on our shows. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2978. That's 292-2978. Or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org. Your participation as audience makes KHOY possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.